We turn now to the scriptures, to a passage that is not in the lectionary, but I thought fit with this theme of Labor Day and the principles of Christ to which we are called. This is from 2 Kings in chapter 5. So if you look up 2 Kings chapter 5, it's on page 465. You can follow along. Well, the stage for this is that in the land of Syria, there's a commander whose name is Naaman. Naaman has leprosy. Naaman, a foreigner and a former enemy of Israel, but he had success. And when he gets this illness of leprosy, it is a foreigner in his household, an Israelite slave girl, who recommends to him to go to Israel because there's a prophet there named Elisha. And the prophet Elisha may be able to heal you. And so the journey unfolds for Nahum to go see the prophet Elisha in another land. So 2 Kings 5, opening verses. Naaman, a general for the king of Aram, was a great man and highly regarded by his master because through him the Lord had given victory to Aram, or Syria. This man was a mighty warrior, but he had a skin disease. Now, Aramean raiding parties had gone out and captured a young girl from the land of Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. And she said to her mistress, "I wish that my master could come before the prophet who lives in Samaria. He would cure him of his skin disease," the prophet Elisha. So Naaman went and told his master, the king, what the young girl from the land of Israel had said. And Aram's king said, "Go ahead, I will send a letter to Israel's king." Let me skip ahead to verse 9. Naaman has finally arrived to Samaria, to Elisha's house. And so Naaman arrived with his horses and chariots. He stopped at the door of Elisha's house, and Elisha sent out a messenger who said, "Go and wash 7 times in the Jordan River. Then your skin will be restored and become clean." But Naaman went away in anger. "I thought for sure that I'd come out and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God. He'd wave his hand over the bad spot, cure the skin disease. Aren't the rivers in Damascus, the Albana and the Pharpar, far better than the rivers of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and get clean?" He turned away in anger and proceeded to leave in anger. But Naaman's servants came up to him and said, Our father, if the prophet had told you to do something difficult, wouldn't you have done the difficult thing? All he said to you was wash in the Jordan and become clean." So Naaman went down, bathed in the Jordan 7 times, just as the man of God had said, and his skin was restored like that of a young boy, and he became healed and clean. He said to his servants, "Now I know for certain that there is no God anywhere on earth except Israel. Please accept a gift from your servant." But Elisha said, "I swear by the life of the Lord I serve that I won't accept anything." Naaman urged Elisha to accept something, but he still refused. Then we skip down to 19. So Elisha said to him, "Go in peace." But when Naaman had gone some distance from Elisha, Gehazi, who was the servant of Elisha, the man of God, thought, My master let this Aramean Naaman off the hook by not accepting the gifts he brought. As surely as the Lord lives, I'll go after him and accept something from him. So Gehazi pursued Naaman. Naaman saw him running after him, so he got off his chariot to meet him. He said, "Is everything okay?" Gehazi said, "Yes, but my master sent me to say, two young men who were members of a group of prophets have just come now to me from the hills of Ephraim. Give them a talent of silver and two changes of fine clothing." Naaman said, "By all means, take two talents of silver." That's like thousands of coins. And so he tied two talents of silver in bags along with two changes of fine clothes. And Naaman gave them to two of his servants, and they carried them in front of Gehazi. When Gehazi arrived at the elevated fortress, he took the items from them and stored them in his house. And then Naaman left. But then Gehazi went and stood before his master. And the prophet Elisha said to Gehazi, "Gehazi, where have you been? Your servant didn't go anywhere." Elisha said, "Wasn't my heart going along with you when the man got off his chariot to meet you? Is this the time to accept silver and clothes, olive trees, vineyards, sheep, cattle, or male and female servants? Naaman's skin disease will now cling to you, Gehazi, and to your descendants forever." And Gehazi left Elisha's presence, flaky like snow, with leprosy. Blessed are those who hear the word of God and perform it. In our story today, after Naaman is healed, the great general, he is so thankful, he becomes a believer. He actually thinks you have to take earth from Israel and then go and where he lives in Syria to worship God and pray to God with this all this dirt and mud that he brought to mule haul loads full of dirt from Israel. And so he says, "I'm going to thank God for my healing all of my days." So he's trying to be a believer. And as he goes and leaves, because Elisha will accept none of the silver and none of the clothes, just the dirt that he takes with him is fine. But it's Gehazi, Elisha's assistant. Gehazi, he thinks to himself, "Boy, you know, we could have really squeezed this new believer from a lot of money. We could really use this for, you know, for our congregation of prophets here." He had visions of getting this American Express card that had no limit if they just accepted these two talents of silver, and of all the fine clothing he bought, he could really be dressed. He could be dressed just, he'd look like a killer, cool guy. And so he goes without telling Elisha, he goes and, of course, tells a lie. He tries to extort money from this man because of the healing that he had just experienced from the goodness of God. Here's this foreigner that he wants to, a powerful foreigner, he's going to take as much money and clothing, Armani clothing or whatever he can get, the designer clothes, Versace, whatever. So he gets all this stuff, telling a lie that some other prophets have come, they have to provide for them. He says that Elisha told him to ask for all this money and clothing. But then when He's back home, and Elisha confronts him. What does he do? He just lies straight to his master's face. When Elisha says, "Where were you, Gehazi? Where were you when I was gone?" He says, "I was nowhere, master." You know, what do we teach our children? We teach them, if you've done something wrong, then admit it, tell the truth, and then we can find a way to forgive you and we can work through the consequences. But if you lie and cover up, it breaks the relationship. It just, the trust is just shattered. Our highest government leaders, so often do they not, when they do wrong, they just lie and lie and cover up and cover up. And what does that do? Sometimes they're eventually caught, but it breaks the fabric. It breaks the connection. It dispirits everyone. It brings us down instead of lifting us up. We could forgive, but the lies and deceit break our heart. They break our society and culture's heart. Who are you when no one is looking? Who am I? There was once a seminary of students preparing for the ministry. They were going through the cafeteria line, okay, as the story is told. And in the cafeteria, one of the first things you came to was this whole bowl of oranges. And someone had written on a little sign in front of the oranges saying, "Please take only one. Jesus is watching." But if you go down the line a little further, came to a whole plate of cookies. And someone else had just written in their own handwriting a little sign, and they put it there and said, "Take as many cookies as you want. Jesus is watching the oranges." There's a Nicolas Cage film called Family Man. You can get on DVD. And it stars also Don Cheadle, who is an angel who's kind of sneaky and tries to catch people. And you don't sure what his motives are, this sneaky angel, Don Cheadle. But so Nicolas Cage is being taught things by this angel. And they are in this store. Nicolas Cage comes into the store. And Don, the sneaky angel, is just acting like a store clerk. And, you know, a young woman comes in, and she buys something. He gives her too much change, a lot too much change. And, you know, she looks at him, and he says, "Is everything okay?" And she says, "Oh, yes." And she leaves. And the angel turns to Nicholas and says, "Look at that. Look at that. For $9, she just gave her soul away. For $9. How often do we do that? We are called to live on our honor, like an honor system of Christ-like relationships, living out the Beatitudes. I remember passing this one floral shop in West Seneca when I was the pastor, and they had out front, they had all these flowers you could buy on the honor system, and because further back was the greenhouse where you could go, you know, and buy the bigger things. And so it said on the front, the honor system, the price of the flowers. Well, I asked the owners of Flowerland, I said, "Do people really, are they good? Do they keep giving money as they should for the things they buy?" And, you know, and she said, "You'd be surprised at how honest people are most of the time. It really works." One time, though, there was someone who took Took flowers, didn't leave any money. Left a note saying, I'm going to send you a check in the mail. And the check came in the mail. Who are you when no one is watching? Are you someone who is known for your honesty, integrity, or do you try to cheat a little bit on your taxes or even cheat on a friend? Who are we? There was the great tennis player, Arthur Ashe, who was someone who worked so hard to stop apartheid in South Africa, one of the first African-American stars and winners of Wimbledon and the U.S. Open and other. He suffered a lot of prejudice early in his life, of course. And he was once in a competition with the great Stan Smith. And as the tennis ball went back and forth, it was a shot by Stan, and then Arthur returned it. It looked like Stan did not reach the ball in time. It looked like it might have bounced a second time. The umpire couldn't tell. Arthur couldn't tell. He went over to the net. As there was a pause in the game, he asked, hey, Stan, did you get to that ball or not? Stan said, yeah, I got to the ball. And Arthur turned to the umpire and said, I concede the point. Later, the reporter said, you know, what kind of fool are you to trust another competitor? And Arthur said, I am no fool. I'm no fool. I would not have taken the word of just anyone. But if Stan Smith says he got to the ball, then he got to the ball. And to this day, every year, the Arthur Ashe Courage Award is given. In his new book, The Second Mountain, the conservative columnist for the New York Times, David Brooks, has written quite a journey, of partly his own journey, of learning about what it takes to be truly a person of character and to find your second calling in life. Your first calling perhaps involves money and career and fame and great accomplishments, even generosity, but the second mountain often comes after suffering, after failure. The second mountain, he says, is when you finally find your life purpose, where your skills and gifts mesh and merge with people who are poor or needy or outcast or disabled, the people you become your family. The people who become your family. He talked about this one couple named Kathy and David in Washington, D.C., in the neighborhoods, in poor neighborhoods. Kathy and David just took in one young man because he was a best friend of one of their son. And when the friend needed a place, suffered abuse in the past, and was a runaway, they took him in. And they started taking in more and more kids. Friends of friends. Soon it was not just one child or young person, it was 27 young people that they grew to love and care for. Teenagers and young adults. And every Thursday, they would have one large family meal where everyone came. But it was step by step, as they fell in love with each young person that had such talent and potential and vision and dream, who had suffered so often homelessness or from drugs or parents who abandoned them, But Kathy and David made this their life work. It was tiring. But these people, David Brooks said, they had a joy, a moral joy. It was so unlike anything he had seen. They saw the light in each kid, and that light glowed from them as well. And a final story, as we reflect on what Christ calls us to. In the Gospel of Luke, Jesus says, when you give a banquet, don't invite the wealthy. Don't invite even your friends and relatives. Invite the poor and the outcast and the forgotten. And then you will receive God's reward in heaven. That's what the Bible study today was about, Luke 14. That's what we are called to do and be. Who do we invite to our banquet and table? This final story is my perfect plan to commit adultery. It is not autobiographical. Don't tell my wife, please. It's a made-up story, but it is a daydream from God to help me be stronger and clearer about living Christ-like beatitudes. I think it came to me in a daydream. Maybe it will help you. I couldn't believe how easy it was to set everything up. The restaurant reservations in a different town, a motel prepaid in cash, roses delivered to the young woman's door with the details, a cover story to my wife about this new guy at work who invited me to a movie marathon. Everything was going great as plotted for this rendezvous. I had reached a point where when monogamy was monotony, and so I thought I would escape into young arms of excitement. From the kitchen table, I could see that my wife was doing our family finances. And I said, I'm leaving now. And she said, okay, honey, have a good time. And I walked out the door. Heading down the sidewalk to my car at the curb, I looked down the street. And there I noticed old Rudy on the porch with his wife who has Alzheimer's. And I marveled at how Rudy was always so cheerful and such a good caregiver. And he always told the passersby, have a great day. I got to my car door and I looked over at the corner where there were the two cars of the young professional couple who had gone through two miscarriages, and they were hoping against hope to expect again. I opened the door and then I noticed there was a woman who was from the gray house walking her dog. I always wondered why she smiled, but with a deep sadness, something terrible that she had to live with and overcome. I climbed into my seat. I put my keys in the ignition, and then I noticed all the toys and all the stuff out front of Trent's house. And then I realized, you know, Trent, he's quirky, but he's a great dad. And he and his wife have been together 14 years through it all. And then I realized, I can't do this. How can I secretly commit adultery when Trent is so faithful to his wife and kids? I would feel like somehow Trent would know a strand of the web that bonds us together would be broken. I would be shredding the social fabric. My moral compass would be gone. Somehow, I realized I can't do that to Trent, or to the young professional couple, or to the single woman, or to Rudy. So I got out of my car, looked up and down the street, went back in my house. My wife asked me, "Hey, honey, did you forget something?" I said, "No, I remembered something." I gave her a kiss on the cheek, and she asked, "What's that for?" And I said, "It's for what you're doing now." She said, "Oh, okay, you're welcome." And she turned to the finances. Back in the kitchen, I thought a long time as I was getting the snack about what connects us one to another. Those invisible bonds that go from heart to heart. We don't always see them, but the bonds are there. And we must not break them. We must cherish them, preserve them, make them holy and strong. And as I was in the kitchen, I thought of a melody just came to mind. Sometimes it happens. A melody just welled up within me. I didn't know what it was. And then I thought, I know the words. Blessed be the tie that binds our hearts in Christian love, the fellowship of kindred minds are like to that above. May it always be so.